Today's episode is a throwback from the archives, where I was honored to have a conversation with my father, George Lee Pinnell, who passed away yesterday after a courageous two-year battle with prostate cancer. He epitomized hope is not a plan. While we all had hope, while we all supported him, he helped pull this care plan together, and we worked with him. And I'll talk about caregivers and hospice and palliative care on a future episode. But for this and the next episode, I want to share his story. His story of going from the steel mill of Pittsburgh to the deep oceans as part of the U.S. Navy submarine service. And then in part two, we'll hear about how he took his submarine service and nuclear reactor knowledge out to the civilian world and helped shape nuclear power, not just for America, but for the world. So please do me the favor of hitting play and listening till the end to hear my father's story. I love you, Dad.
Welcome to the Hope is Not a Plan podcast, where we address tough questions head on, face our problems, and highlight our hopes by providing actionable planning steps to improve ourselves, mind, body, and spirit. Now, let's get logged in and get locked on to this episode of the Hope is Not a Plan podcast.
Talking to my father, a fellow Navy veteran. In fact, we're a couple generations in with the Navy, but I'm really happy and honored that my dad's come on, and we're going to talk about some really interesting things from where he's from, his service, and particularly nuclear power, because I think it's an area folks aren't really that educated in, but are fearful of. So hopefully we can dispel some of those fears, educate some folks. And honestly, I just get to talk to my dad, so it's pretty awesome. So thanks for coming on. My dad's name is George Pinnell, for all of you who's not his son. But thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
It's good to see you. So I know most of the answers to these, except for the nuclear stuff. I'll be refreshed on that certainly when we get to it. But to share with everybody, you know, some of the you know, your life journey and stuff, where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a little steel town called Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. It's about 20 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. And I grew up there with a lot of other people that wanted to get out of there because nobody wanted to work in that steel mill for 35 years. So our dads were pretty clever. They got us work in the summer in the steel mill. And if that didn't convince you to become a pro athlete or study your butt off in college, nothing ever would. So that's why a lot of athletes come out of there. I was a pretty good athlete. I didn't know my real dad. So during that time, fortunately, my mother found a guy that was a really good mentor, my stepdad, your grandpap.
Yep.
And so we all worked really hard to be the best we could be in that little steel town. You really didn't want to have to work in that mill for 35 years. So in high school, I was a pretty good athlete. The problem was I spent more time playing sports than studying. So I didn't do as well in high school as I did in other areas. So, but I do hold a record. I used to pitch for the high school team.
Right.
On one of the games, we used to only play seven innings instead of nine. So in one game, I had 17 strikeouts in seven innings. Holy smokes. I think that's still a Beaver County record, as far as I know.
That's pretty awesome.
But we, there's a variety of things we learned from sports, which was one, sportsmanship, two, how to train hard, play hard, but shake hands after the game was over and that sort of thing. So it taught you a lot of life lessons.
In addition to baseball, basketball was your other big sport too.
Yeah. I used to love to play basketball. So matter of fact, when we were going to college, all the guys would be home for the summer, and we'd get together on the playground basketball court in the afternoon, and we'd play 2 or 3 hours. Then we'd go work the mid shift in the mill.
Oh, wow.
Then we'd come back and do it again the next day.
Yeah.
And those were the days where it was truly no blood, no foul. Quit your whine and shoot the ball.
And just go. Yeah.
Just go.
And I remember, you know, talking about the mill and some stories and getting some, I don't know if it's the right term, if it's slag, but basically hot molten metal in your shoe or something on you, right? Some of the hazards of
Well, one of my jobs one summer was when they pour steel, they've got this gigantic ladle. And the way it works is there's a stopper in the bottom of the ladle. And the way that works is there's a steel rod surrounded by what they call fire brick. And there's a little pneumatic piston that the guy that's pouring the steel operates to open the stopper and close the stopper. And then when the ladle is empty, somebody has to retrieve that stopper rod.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my jobs was the guy in the crane would bring the ladle over and then he would tip it over facing me. So you were like walking into the sun. Then you went up, hit out, knocked out a taper pin and hauled that rod out of there with the fire brick. Well, part of your job was to then break the fire brick off the steel rod because they had to put it back on there. Well, one day a piece of that hot fire brick went in my shoe, and I think I hold the world's record for taking a high top shoe off without untying it and throwing it about 20 feet.
Oh my gosh.
So that's why you didn't want to stay in that mill.
Yeah.
It's hard work. And our dads were pretty smart. They convinced us, hey, study, learn to play ball, do something. Don't end up here like we did for 35 or 40 years. I mean, it was a good living.
Yeah, for sure.
Boy, it was hard.
You got to want to be there. And for Grandpap, he was a chemist.
Yeah, it was
right in chemist. The mill. Chemist in the mill.
Yeah, so what they do is they do a heat of steel, and it had to meet certain specifications. So after it solidified, they whack off a sample, send it to the lab, and he would evaluate whether that steel met spec or not, as far as gotcha. What chemical constituents were in there. And it depends on the type of heat they ran, you know, high quality steel to just run in the mill stuff and that, but he'd have to let them know if the heat was okay or not. So,
and this was in kind of the heyday of American steel, right? In the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And the problem was later on, as I got older, it was clear the guys in the local mills weren't keeping up with the world. Nah. And the problem was a lot of the guys running the mill were ex-World War II guys, like generals, senior people, and they couldn't change with the times.
Gotcha.
So the Japanese just went right by us. They started making steel. They had different techniques. They could crank out more high quality steel than we could, and that was kind of the demise of the U.S. steel, basically. Gotcha. We got run over by the train.
Oh, was that from just their efficiencies and the methodologies they started using? Just they could
put
out more steel faster.
More modern ways to do it, faster ways to do it, produce higher quality. Of course, they used technology instead of doing wet testing like your grandpap did. They had machines to do it. They'd run a little sample through there, and it would spit out quality of the steel. Gotcha. So we just, it's like the old saying, if you're sitting still on the tracks, eventually the train's going to run you over. So that's what happened to the U.S. steel business.
Yeah. And especially in that area, it was a huge, huge negative impact to thousands of people in that area.
Oh, yeah.
The mill started shutting down.
Absolutely. Well, you couldn't, when you're going when the mill was going full blast, you could not see across the river for the buildings, all the buildings. Tin mill, wire mill. No, just
the buildings.
You couldn't look across the river because the buildings overlapped and they were two or three stories high. And
wow.
Now they're all gone. It's all flat. So that's what happens if you don't keep up.
Right.
And realize you're in the world market, not just the U.S. market. That's what I think happened to our U.S. steel business.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and even at a smaller level, if you're leading a project or a big program, and I always say, don't, as much as I'm a stickler for a good looking and well put together plan, when you fall in love with your plan and you won't let go of it,
you got it.
It's going to be a problem.
The train's coming.
Yeah. And even, when whether it's now in healthcare or in public safety, before the plans we would make, particularly with the guys who used to work with in public safety, we knew as soon as I print that, it's out of date. right? Yep. That's why have a red pen. That's why when you do a briefing and someone says, no, it's this now, and you're like, oh, crap.
Especially these days. You got to even be quicker before the train catches up to you.
That's true. That's a good point. So, so not wanting to stay in the mills, playing sports, getting ready to graduate, what took you from, you know, the baseball fields and the basketball courts of Aliquippa to the United States?
I ended up getting, my grades weren't that great in high school, but I got into Penn State Extension Campus in McKeesport.
Mm-hmm.
So I took up what a course called Electrical and Electronics Technology. So it was a 2-year associate degree.
Okay.
So I got a little smarter in terms of studying. So I got pretty good grades there and got in the honor society.
Nice.
Then after I got out of there, I got a job with IBM up in Endicott, New York.
Okay.
What I used to do for them up there. IBM at that time, that was like 66. They made all their own stuff. They made chips, circuit boards, everything they needed to build computers. None of it was outsourced. They had buildings with no windows that were super clean, where they made chips and all that stuff.
Right.
So my job at that time was to test the complex logics that were going into the computers that were building. At that time, they were building what they called a Model 360, which for the time was probably the most advanced computer going on at the time. So interesting story about how simple things make a difference. So I'm sitting at my bench one day testing circuits, and somebody walks in with this box full of circuit cards, about 10 of them.
Hmm.
And they were sent back from the UK. They had sent them over to the UK as part of IBM over there, and none of them worked. So I set one up on the bench, started testing it. Sure enough, about halfway through the logic, quit working. Then I grabbed another one, start testing it halfway through the logic in the same place, quit working. Grabbed one more just to confirm I wasn't screwed up, right?
Yeah.
Tested the logic, stopped in the same place in the logic. I'm going, that's weird.
Yeah.
So I went and pulled the drawings. They used to etch their own circuit boards. And one of the design things they used to do, because of some of the frequencies on the boards, you'd never put a 90-degree circuit in there. It always had to be a 45. When you transition and you need to make a 90-degree turn, there was no sharp corners. So you had to 45 it, right? So I go back to the original drawing for the board, and I look down there, and I traced it to where the logic kept not working. And I looked down there, and sure enough, a guy, and it was in pencil, these lines on the drawing.
Uh-huh.
He had inadvertently put a 90 in there, and he erased it, but he didn't put the 45 back.
And
they etched the board. These boards were like 10 grand a piece or something.
Oh, no.
And they etched it that way. So I just toted them all over. Right across the hall was a shop where they did soldering and stuff. I said, hey, guys, I need you to put me a jumper from this hole to that hole. Poof.
Problem solved.
They worked.
So they can go back.
That goes to show you, in terms of paying attention to detail, what can happen. If maybe it got, whoever was doing it got distracted. Could be a him or her. Who knows? Yeah. They erased it, intended to do the right thing, make 45, probably walked away and said, oh, I think I'm done. They sent it off to the etching place, and they made the board that way. So interesting. What you learned.
I mean, a lot of lessons too there, right, of when either you or maybe folks on your team, when you feel like, or, you know, you've taken too much on, you feel overwhelmed, maybe step back and slow down.
Yep.
Also, if you're leading teams, and I've seen this, and I've made this mistake of not more proactively helping my team members manage their level of work, when it's too much, when you can see, hey, this is falling behind or that's there. But also, I think, too, and you know, for me, starting in IT to get where I am now, like crawling under desks, fixing computers, always started the hardware level. So to your point, going back and looking at, okay, same place, where's the place? And then with your education and background, knowing, you know, the boards a bit, but then also accepting, hey, we can fix this. So you help troubleshoot it and find a solution, not just go, oh, it's all ruined. And, you know, we have to scrap this. So,
well, you never give up. To me, the way I approach things, I was pretty good electronics technician in the Navy, but my attitude was no dumb machine is going to defeat me. I don't care what's wrong with it. I'm going to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's a dumb machine. So something in there is busted. The tough ones, though, as you've probably experienced, is the intermittent problem.
Yeah.
I'd rather see smoke than I know where it is.
Yeah.
As opposed to something that comes and goes. And then you got to try and chase it down or catch it at the right time and figure it out.
Yeah.
Just like your problem in the children's hospital here recently.
Yeah.
Something was going wacky and you had to kind of chase it down.
Follow that. Yeah. Look at the constants. What's the same? Is it the same place, same time? Yeah. Is it not? Is it? Yeah. When it's random times and locations and other things. Yeah.
Makes it tougher.
That's super hard.
But the biggest thing I've learned over time in whatever I did is persistence. Don't get all upset. Don't get frustrated. Just step back a minute, just like you said, and say, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah.
and get some good people involved.
Yeah.
Actually, I found in meetings, the best thing you can do, there's always the ones that want to talk all the time. And they're probably the ones that know the least. They just kind of want to show out the meeting. The ones you need to draw in are the ones that are just sitting there quiet, because they probably have a lot to offer. They're just not comfortable in a meeting environment talking. So you would kind of draw them into the conversation, and sure enough, they pop something out and you go, aha,
that's a good point.
Something we hadn't thought about.
Yeah.
And actually, I found bringing people into the meeting that were less technically oriented,
ask
the best questions, because they don't know what the heck you're talking about, but they're going, well, did you guys think about this? And we'd go, no.
Yeah.
we did not think about that.
Yeah.
But thanks for bringing it up, you know?
Yeah.
So you never blame anybody. You just get them involved. Plus they feel better about themselves when they can contribute. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard a good, Wendy and I, and for listeners, Wendy's my wife, went to an education session this week. And one of the great points, it was about kind of healthy conflict, right? Which is a tool. It's not bad to have conflict if it's respectful, all that good stuff. But but the tool was specifically for, you know, there's like systems one folks, like just emotionally active, and system two, where I got to sit back and think about it, and all these different, you know, personality types. But the tool was in a meeting, kind of like you talked about, find a way to draw them in. But the way to draw them in, or kind of setting the ground rules, was nobody can talk twice until everybody has talked once or spoken at least once. Yeah. Right. So all the folks that are outspoken and want to, you know, they're excited, and for whatever reason, they just want to get it out there, be like, cool, but you've already said something. Let's go to John Smith. What do you think? And help and call on them. 'Cause you're right. I mean, one, especially in technology, a lot of folks like technology because they can just sit there with the technology, not necessarily with people.
Right.
And but those are the assets on your team when you can have, you know, for me now, a mix of clinical and technical and business folks.
Yeah.
And we're going, hey, what's going on? And we need either the heavy technical person that doesn't really want to talk or speak up, but we need that. Or from somewhere else. But yeah, so that's a great point of, you know, if you have folks in your meetings. Hopefully, one, you're populating your meetings with folks that need to be there.
Yeah.
But that you, if someone's just kind of sitting there and you're like, hey, that person probably has a different perspective or a good perspective, like call on them.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the other thing too is during the meeting, especially when you're leading the meeting, it's not just all the verbals. You sit back when somebody's talking and look around the table.
Yeah.
And see who's fidgeting and really wants to say something, but they're afraid. You could tell.
Yeah.
They kind of squirm in their seat, or they got some weird expression on their face or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you figure out a way to get them to respond without embarrassing them. You know, just try and get them to, you approach them and say, Hey, John, you know, it'd be helpful to hear what you have to say. I think you got something to offer, as opposed to, come on, John, say something.
Right.
Whole different deal, right?
Yeah. Elicit a very different response. I think that's, you know, with us being remote for, I've been remote for 4 years and then kind of we had to be remote for a couple of years or a year and a half, whatever. Yeah. But the lost value of being in the same room, I think, is huge and in the same office.
Oh, yeah.
But I think we can make up for it a bit if kind of like we are now on, you know, for folks watching this on YouTube. But as we are regularly either on a Zoom or a Teams call or is the value of being on camera to me is huge. And I think honestly should be a standard, right? If you're in a business meeting, you should be seen.
Yep.
Because you just get a lot more out of it. Like to this point, I can see how you're acting. You're responding to this. Is there a question? Right. You getting ready to say something, you know, all those things you just mentioned.
Yep.
So even now in this, you know, remote hybrid, and I know some companies are trying to bring folks back or are, even remotely, you can read those things, which I think is a huge value.
I'm a highly technical guy, but I've learned over the years, it's the soft stuff that matters. When you're dealing with it's harder to deal with people than a machine. I can figure out what a machine's doing. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
What's going through somebody's brain? No, not so easy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
not so easy.
So unlike the surface ship behind you, for the folks in the video,
we used to call those targets.
Yeah. You spent lots of time under the sea.
Yeah.
In a submarine in the Navy. Yeah. So what took you from IBM to there?
Well, if you recollect that time frame, you may not remember, is Vietnam was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at IBM for about a year and my draft number came up. And my boss tried like crazy to get me a deferment, but he couldn't do it. So I said, well, if I'm going in the service, I'm going to decide for myself what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
As opposed to being over in the rice paddies in Vietnam with a gun. So I decided to join the Navy. That's how I ended up in the Navy. And then, of course, with my associate's degree in electronics, they sent me to ET school in Great Lakes, right?
Electronics technician.
Yeah. So the guys used to all get mad at me because all the stuff they were teaching was like, to me, it was like, I'd take the test, I'd be done in 15 minutes, get 100 and go on Liberty. And they're still sitting there scratching their head.
Yeah.
So what ended up happening is some guys were struggling, so they would come to my barracks and I'd hold class in the evening and say, okay, guys, I'll get you through this. Let's just do it. But they used to hate when we take tests. I'd be done in 15 minutes. And they'd all look at me like, USOB, you're going on Liberty. And I'm in here trying to answer these stupid questions.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was doing that. And of course, I had enlisted initially for 4 years. And I walked past this poster one day. It said, nuclear submarines. That looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I went and talked to a chief who had been on submarines. And he said, well, here's what's all about. Here's what the nuclear stuff's about. It's pretty tough program, but you know, if you want to do it, you can do it, but you got to sign up for another 2 years.
Gotcha.
So I said, so I went back to the barracks, thought about it, said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So that's how I ended up in the in submarines.
Wow.
So basically of my 6 years in the service, the first three of it was all schooling between electronics school. There was a little lull before I went to nuclear power school. There's two parts of nuclear training. One is the theoretical part. That's 6 months. So you do about three years worth of college in 6 months.
Wow.
There's none of the fluff stuff. None of the English literature
great
stuff.
Nuclear action.
It was just core physics, heat transfer, fluid flow, all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
And in that program, there was no slack.
I bet.
If you weren't cutting it, your butt was out of there.
Right.
So there weren't many options. Either you cut it or you didn't cut it.
Right.
So at the time, your mom was pregnant with our first baby. So we were in Havre de Grace, Maryland. That's where the theoretical was. And then we were going up to Saratoga Springs.
Okay.
At Saratoga Springs, they have a on-land hunk of a submarine that had the nuclear power plant, all that in. So that's where you got the hands-on training. So that was a critical point in our lives because mom carried the baby 9 months. It was stillborn, and I was in the middle of trying to finish prototype of Saratoga Springs.
Right.
So I had a decision to make. So, am I going to be able to hack it and get through this thing? Because that program in the Navy is the hardest one in the military.
Yeah.
And so what pushed me back to getting finished is after we got through taking care of things because of the baby, I went back to muster. I guess it was only a few days. And I was standing at attention, and one of the guys walked over to me and handed me a bunch of money that the guy said, you know, volunteered because he knew what happened.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, this kind of people I want to work with. So that's right. How I made it through that part. I just had to make a decision, and we got through that.
Right.
So before I went to the submarine, well, before I went to the nuclear power school, I was at the sub tender. And because there's kind of a queue to get in nuke school. So that was about a 9 month stint down in Norfolk. So I worked on electronics there were still some old World War II submarines around.
Oh, wow.
And so I would calibrate their electronics. And actually, I mean, I'd be up 12, 14 hours a day sometimes calibrating this stuff. It was what they call electronic countermeasures. It's a thing they raise up from the submarine, and it can detect various frequencies of people transmitting and stuff.
Oh, wow.
But these tuners were very high frequency. So if you had the side plate off the tuner and you waved your hand by it, you could see the frequency change in the tuner.
Wow.
That's how sensitive they were. Huh. So I'd work all night calibrating these things, and the guys from one of the submarines would come up and get them. And I'd go outside the shop and look over the rail. I was on the Orion at the time. And they'd go down the pier, and I'd watch them drop them down to their buddy.
After you just calibrated it.
In the submarine, I'm going, oh, man, you guys are killing me.
Oh, man.
But when I was on there, because of my work and helping those guys out, I got Sailor of the Quarter for,
oh, nice.
For helping them out. But all my hard work, and then they just dropped the tuner down into the guy below.
I'm maybe going, threw it off a little.
Crap, man. Jeez. I don't know if that thing's still in tune or not. So anyway, I got through that. And that was also the time, I don't know if you recall this, but when the Scorpion got lost, submarine.
Okay.
And they couldn't figure out. When I got there, everybody was kind of down the dumps because they were trying to figure out what happened to the Scorpion.
Right.
And what they theorized later, there was all kind of studies and smart guys trying to figure it out, was they had a track on it, and it was going along. And if a torpedo lights off, it's got a mechanism in it that if it makes a 180-degree turn, it shuts down. That's so you don't shoot yourself.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
For example, if you launched one, you know, and decided to turn around and come back at you, it would shut down. Well, they made a maneuver just like that for having that kind of problem. Well, apparently it didn't work. And later on, what they found was there was a vendor tech note that said, we've been having problems with the batteries, this kind of battery. The battery in that torpedo is right next to the warhead.
Oh, no.
And the tech note was they would short and overheat.
Oh.
So they found the remains of the submarine, and sure enough, the side was blown out, you know, splayed out.
Yeah.
It didn't cave in. So that torpedo apparently went off while it was in the sub. So.
And was that one of the nuclear submarines or a World War II sub?
That was a nuclear one. Nuclear. Yep, yep.
Wow.
Yep, yep. So anyway, I got all through that, and that was just excellent training.
Right.
So I rode the submarine around for 3 years. And that's kind of tough duty. You sometimes I was gone from you guys and mom for a week, and then sometimes a month, and then sometimes 2 months, and whatever. And it was difficult to, you get people, you train people to stay on certain watch stations.
Uh-huh.
And you usually have three people qualified per watch station. So that means you stay on a 6 hour watch and then you're off 12 hours. Well, in that 12 hours, you got to eat, sleep, do your laundry, whatever, then go back on watch. And you're always moving around the clock, right? So if you stand the midnight to six, you're off 12, and then you're on a different time frame for the next watch.
Gotcha.
If you don't have three people qualified, you stand what they call port and starboard.
Mm.
That means you're on six, you're off six. Now you got to do all that same stuff in 6 hours.
Right.
Sleep, eat. And after about 2 weeks of that, you're like, no.
Wow.
And you start to worry about your judgment. See, you're at that reactor panel and you're just whipped. So you try and get somebody qualified as quick as you can.
I was going to say that's an incentive point, right? To expand your resources there a bit.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing about going through that process. And a lot of people weeded out by the time they got to the submarine. But it was interesting in terms of people's skills, right? So there was always the people that I used to hate these people. They could read a book and it would just like suck into the brain. So if you ask them a question, they'd say, well, on page 15, third paragraph down, third sentence, it says this.
Right.
But you put them in a control room with 500 alarms going off, they couldn't deal with it. But you don't get rid of those people. You just say, okay, what can they do? You make them instructors, right? You don't put them in a control room.
Right.
So to tamp down some of the ego sometimes when you're getting somebody qualified on the submarine, they had a qual card. So they'd say, well, I studied system so-and-so, and then you would quiz them to see if they really knew the system, knew how it worked and all that stuff.
Right.
So there was always, again, there's one of the smart alecks thought, oh man, I'm smarter than anybody. So, oh, really? So our trick used to be, so we'd ask them the normal questions, you know, how's the system work and what are the parameters and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And of course they just whip out this stuff. Then I'd say, let's say they were trying to get qualified on an electric propulsion motor. That's electric motor that's wrapped around the shaft in case you can't power the submarine with steam.
Okay.
So you can get this big old electric motor that drives the shaft. So they'd get close to the end and they were getting pretty cocky. And I'd say, well, what's the serial number on the electric propulsion motor? They go, do I need to know that? Of course not.
Right.
Of course you don't need to know that.
What am I going
to
tell you?
But you get a little cocky.
Yeah.
And not only that, how many bolts are holding the end plate on the motor? Do you know that? Well, no. I said, well, if you want to get qualified, you better learn this stuff. So you put a pin in their ego balloon.
Of course, you're going to
sign them off. Then you kind of temper their thinking. They go, well, maybe I'm not as smart as I think I am.
Yeah. What was during your training pipeline, what was the probably biggest drop point where you lost the most people? Out of training.
Well, it was both. The theory class was pretty rigorous.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't hack it, you were off doing something else. The Navy's pretty strict about that. And then if you got through that part, you had to make it through that prototype and actually operate the reactor and test things and all that stuff. So that was another screen. The other one was in submarine school, there's a 50-foot water tank in Connecticut. And you do a free ascent from the bottom of that tank up. And about every 10 feet, there's a Navy diver, right? So when you enter the equalization chamber, the pressure in that chamber has to equal the depth of the tower, right? So you go open the door and people can go in there. So you go in this little chamber, the instructor's sitting on a bench in the middle, and there's a guy on each side of him. So you pressurize that chamber to equal the 50 foot. And as soon as somebody starts sweating or squirming, he says, out.
Right.
You're out of here.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing was, so you get in the thing, and what you do is inflate a vest and do a free ascent up the tower. The thing is, now the air in your lungs is pressurized, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't exhale all the way up, your lungs are going to blow up. Right. So when you get to that first diver, if he doesn't see air coming out your nose or your mouth or both, he just grabs you by the ankle, which is another kind of, if you're claustrophobic
yeah.
and you're underwater,
not great.
You're not going to do well.
Right.
So he just wants you to start exhaling. Then he'll let you go. The next guy's watching you. And of course, then you're just like blowing air out. You don't want to get held by the ankle anymore.
No doubt.
So that's another screen. That's another way. You don't want somebody that's that afraid of water and stuff and tight places to be in a submarine. That's no place for them. So
yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. What was your favorite thing about kind of the submarine service and life? I mean, you mentioned the people that were amazing, which in both subservice and I think the military in general, it, you know, you have that brother and sisterhood that it never goes away either, which is awesome. Yeah. But as a submariner, what was your kind of favorite takeaway, which is probably, I don't know if it's hard to single out one thing, but.
Well, it's just, it's maybe a trite saying, but it's the teamwork. It's the synergy, because you're all dependent on one another to stay alive.
Yeah, right? Every point.
A third of the crew or half of it's got to sleep, right? While the other half's doing their job. So you got to have faith that they're going to be able to do their job.
Right.
So that's another interesting story. So we went to Portsmouth for a year to do an overhaul in the submarine. So they cut a big hole in the hull. You haul equipment out of there, refurbish it, stick it down, back down the hole, put it in place and all that stuff.
Did you say they cut a hole?
Oh, yeah. That's the only way you can get the equipment out of there.
Right. That seems nerve-wracking. Like, we're going to cut it and we promise you we still
Then they
got to
weld
good.
It back up, right? So then you haul the equipment out of there, refurbish it, stick it back where it belongs, test it, of course. So then once you're all done and they weld the submarine back up, you got to test it. Mm-hmm. So you go do sea trials, right? So one of the tests you do, besides, I tested all the electronics and all that, make sure it was working. So we were having a problem with one of the systems, electronic systems. So I was up for like 3 days.
Wow.
Stand my watch, troubleshoot for whatever, 18 hours. Mm-hmm. Stand my watch again. And so I used to sleep in the first class quarters, which is in the front lower part of the submarine, in the bow, near the bow. And I'm three bunks up from the deck, right? So I just about get off to sleep. My head, when I was sleeping, faced forward. So when I got off watch, we were at 1,000 feet doing a flank bell, which is as fast as a submarine can go forward, which is about 30 miles an hour. And then we're going to do what we call a crash back. So they were going to go ahead flank to back emergency. That means you reverse the screw and you're testing the shaft and the seals and all that stuff, all the mechanical drive for the submarine, right?
Is that just in case you're going to hit something or something's in your way?
Well, yeah, you got it. Well, I mean, you're just trying to test that all that is
all the parts.
So just in case you need to. To use it, you know, the submarine's going to work like it's supposed to work. So,
gotcha.
So I'm just about off to sleep, and all of a sudden I feel this pressure on my head, and my eyes pop open, and my feet are at about a, I don't know, 15 degree angle above my head.
Hmm.
About 10 seconds later, they're at about a 30 degree angle above my head. About 10 seconds later, they're like at a 45. So my head is pressing against the end of the bunk, right?
Oh, wow.
And your instinct is to jump out of the bunk.
Get out, yeah.
Well, when you look over the edge of that bunk, you're not looking at the deck anymore. You're looking at the forward bulkhead of the room, of the space. Wow. If you jump out of the rack, three racks up, you're going to fall the length of the compartment. Oof. Not only that, the ladder you had to get out of it was a vertical ladder to get in and out of that space. Right.
Right.
So now it's a monkey bar. It's not a ladder anymore. It's at a 45 degree angle. So I'm grabbing beams and wires and we're all scrambling. What is going on?
Right.
Well, what happened was they did the crash back, what we call crash back. And the guys on the planes thought we still had headway. In other words, we were going forward. So they took control action as though you were going forward. Well, if you're backing up, it has exactly the opposite effect, right? So those of us who went to bed thought we were going down at a 45 degree angle. And we're going in about 30 seconds, we're all going to die.
Right? Just going straight down, so, picking your.
Yeah. At a 45 degree angle at flank speed, we're going, oh crap, that's not good.
Yeah.
And sure enough, what happened was the captain was even confused. He came up. Now think, the whole submarine's at 45 degrees now. So walking and just getting out of your compartment is a task.
Right.
So you don't slide the length of a compartment or so. And he realized what was going on. And he just ordered that they blow the forward ballast tanks. And when they did that, it brought the nose of the submarine back up. But those of us that went to bed, knowing what the conditions were at the time, were going, oh, crap, I don't want to die this way. So we're all trying to figure out what the heck is going on. What can we do to help? So that's the deal. I mean, those guys were just, if I had to go in the service, I'd do the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of people there. Our biggest thrill as a submarine crew was when we played in the fast pitch softball league. So we had 100 people to choose from to form up a softball team, right?
Right.
Well, it just so happened that one of the auxiliary men was really a great pitcher. I mean, he could zing that thing. And of course, I played ball all my life. And so we put together a team. And we used to play the Marines. We used to play carriers, right? They got 5,000 people to choose
from. Yeah, to choose from.
Our greatest thrill was we beat a carrier team. We celebrated for 3 days.
Nice.
So anyway.
Inter-service rivalries.
Yeah, it's the small things in life, right?
So seriously. All that stuff. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I think your service helped prepare me for mine. Getting a little Navy before I got into the Navy. So which was interesting because, you know, boot camp, and I think I said this when I talked to another Travis Model who does a Elbows Tight Jiu-Jitsu podcast. He was in the Navy. He's out in Washington State now, actually.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about just, you know, when you're ready for it, boot camp, and then your ongoing schools, you know, not all of them, but boot camp in particular, when you see folks that aren't used to at least a little discomfort,
or
a little stress. Even that gets them just going in the gate, let alone the whole pipeline that you went through. Yeah. So it's something I definitely always impressed me, you know, about what you've done and what you did. And just, you know, there's so much I know we've talked about with subs and now so fortunate to have other folks in our family and the sub service too, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's something that when I was born, I have the capability to block out noise. I mean, it could be bombs going off and I can focus on whatever needs attention. The noise doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
So I can zero in on stuff and I don't care if 500 alarms are going off. I know exactly what I need to look at, what to do. So that's what differentiates folks that can be in the control room and folks that can't.
That's a great point.
But like I said, you don't throw those people away.
Right.
Like in your field, if maybe they're not good technically, but maybe they might be good writers of technical material.
Right.
Right. Maybe they can't do what you do, but they sure can help the team out by writing instructions or doing whatever.
Yeah.
They're just not good at that other stuff.
Yeah. I can definitely tell them a mix of you and mom, because I for sure probably have a little more emotion. But then when it comes to, say, like trauma or injury.
Yep.
That's where I zone in and
focus,
solve the problem. What's going on? Boom, boom, boom.
Yep.
Then fluctuated other times. So it's interesting though, how the same kind of mindset can transfer to disciplines.
Yep.
Right. Whether you're, you know, figuring out why your sub's descending so quickly
yep.
or the board, like at IBM, or stopping bleeding or working through systems that you know in a rapid manner. I think that seems to be the blend of, sure, you got to know some of the book work, and then you got to know how to apply it, and then you got to know how to draw from all of that and your experience and others' experience, to your point, that are on your team as well, which is huge.
Yeah. So after the Navy, I got out in 73. And so my first job was with Virginia Power.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to part one of the talk with my late father, George Purnell. Part two will be coming up in about a week. For more on how to take your hopes to actionable plans and more resources, go to hopesnotaplan.com. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Stay safe, wash your hands, and Godspeed.